Welcome to the Space Show, Peter.
Thank you, Andrew.
What efforts are being made on our part then to listen to signals coming from other civilizations?
Well, over the past 31 years, 32 years now, there have been over 60 searches made by astronomers around the world. For the most part, these searches have been sporadic. They've used just the equipment that was available at the radio telescopes. They've focused on a few stars or a few particular frequencies that they tune to. There have been a few more dedicated searches where they're done full-time or close to full-time. They've covered a large number of stars or perhaps even the entire sky. But out of all of those searches, there haven't been any confirmed signals. And I say confirmed signals because every so often, when you use a radio telescope and point in a certain direction, you'll get a signal that you can't explain. And most likely it's due to an instability in your receiving equipment, or it might be a transmitter just down the street or a satellite in orbit. But it's very difficult to confirm this or to explain this if you make an observation one day and then don't analyze your data until perhaps weeks or months later. And that's the usual problem encountered in previous SETI searches. In the NASA SETI program, we will be processing the data in real time. Basically, as the data come in, they're stored briefly and then processed in no more time than it took to store or acquire the data.
Just a reminder, SETI is?
Oh, I'm sorry. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. In NASA, we very often use acronyms for everything. In fact, we even have an acronym called a TLA, which stands for three-letter acronym.
Okay, yes, well, Australians love acronyms as well. So what brings you to Australia?
Well, we have a large-scale project that we plan to start conducting observations in the fall of this year, fall of Northern Hemisphere in October. We have a two-part search strategy where in one part we will focus on stars like the Sun out to a distance of about 100 light years, and the other strategy will cover the entire sky. In both cases, we have to observe stars or we have to observe sky that are not visible from the Northern Hemisphere. Hence, we come to Australia. In my particular case, I'm here with a couple of colleagues, and we've been using the Parkes telescope, the 64-meter antenna at Parkes, to conduct a survey of the interference environment. What types of signals are made by our own technology that could look very much like the signals we would expect from another technology?
By talking about Parkes, we're referring, of course, to a radio telescope.
Yes.
So have you found any? You have to go back and analyze your results, I presume.
Well, we've done a preliminary analysis, and it's very encouraging. We were very pleased by the results. We've examined telescopes in many parts of the world, some of them in very isolated regions that are supposed to be protected from interference. But there's always some leakage, some breaking of the rules, and transmitters are affecting the observations at these observatories. But Parkes was remarkably quiet, and we're delighted with the results so far. We will be processing the results for the next few months to look for any low-level interfering signals. But after our preliminary look, it appears as though we will be able to come down to Parkes in 1994 and use the telescope without having to take a great deal of effort in programming our computers to recognize the interference.
How are we going to decide which stars to look at?
Well, we start with star catalogs. There have been a great number of observations over the last century trying to classify many of the stars in the sky. And we start with that as a preliminary list of stars like the Sun. We can judge them in terms of their temperature and their mass. And we have two scientists associated with the project who are now looking at those stars in more detail, trying to judge their age, trying to judge whether they have a companion star that might be orbiting too close to the main star. And by October of this year, we expect to have a list of 1,000 stars like the Sun out to a distance of 100 light years. And these will be selected as being not only the same temperature and mass as the Sun, but approximately the same age so that any planet around that star would have had time to evolve life and perhaps even intelligent life.
The mind boggles. You know, there's billions of stars out there. I mean, if you just took 1 second on each star, listening to each star, a million stars would take you 12 days, mm-hmm. continuously observing.
Right.
And there are billions of stars out mm-hmm. there. As I said, how are you going to decide which one? And you pretty
yes.
well explained that.
Yes. And there's another problem. We talk about it as finding a needle in a haystack, but it's not an ordinary needle in an ordinary haystack. It's a needle in a cosmic haystack that has more than three dimensions. We've talked about selecting the stars, and we have a procedure for doing that. We also have to choose what frequency to tune to. And even after we make all of the best assumptions we can in terms of what is the quietest part of the radio spectrum against which we could hear a faint alien whisper, if you will, that still contains, that region of the spectrum still contains 2 billion possible channels. Now, you can't take an ordinary radio receiver and listen to each channel successively, one after another, because even if you spend only a second, you'll spend tens of years listening to those channels for each star. So what we've done is we've built special-purpose computers. Well, basically, in fact, there are special-purpose supercomputers that can listen simultaneously to tens of millions of channels for a variety of different signal types. And all of this is done in real time while the data are coming in from the radio telescope. And that's what really distinguishes the NASA search.
Well, assuming then that we do find a signal eventually, what then?
Well, after the champagne, we actually, in fact, before the champagne, we go through a process of confirming the signal. The experiment we were performing is very difficult, and there is a fair chance that we could be fooled by some problem in our equipment or a satellite that we don't know of, and we won't really believe a signal until we confirm it by observations at an independent observatory using independent equipment. But once we're convinced that the signal is real, we announce it to the world. Our goal is to organize the formal announcements, the press conferences, in a very short time, perhaps a day or two after the discovery. We will already have basically announced it to the scientific community by asking for a confirmation from another observatory. And the reason for this is we feel as though this is a signal that wasn't transmitted to California or France or Australia, but is a signal that's transmitted to the planet Earth. And it's something that all residents of planet Earth deserve to know about as quickly as possible.
So there'll be no attempt to hide it or cover it up?
Absolutely not.
What are the prospects for two-way communication? Should we, you know, get the signal and it proves to be fairly continuous?
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting question. There are two aspects to it. The first thing is whether we reply, and if so, who replies? And we're now going through a process of exploring this question in a variety of international scientific and legal organizations, and their plan is to put together a document that will be presented to the United Nations to formalize the process of how a response would be crafted. I assume eventually, after all the politics is done, we would respond to this signal that we receive, but we can't expect the type of communication that we can have talking to our next-door neighbor, because in this case, our next-door neighbor might be tens of light-years away, and the signal we send in response to theirs could take decades to arrive there, and their response would take decades to arrive back here.
A bit like correspondence in the old days before telecommunications.
Oh, even worse. But it's not a completely fruitless communication. After all, we're having, in a sense, a communication with ancient Greece, ancient Rome, Shakespeare. These are one-way communications, but they're very beneficial to us. We can learn things from these ancient civilizations. And in fact, I think by trying to understand what we learn from another civilization on another planet, we will come to learn a great deal about ourselves as we try and understand how they think and how they organize their society. I think it will give us insight into how we think and how our society works.
Yes, I can imagine there'd be many people who'd say, hey, just keep quiet. We don't want to talk back. Because, you know, when you realize the impact that one civilization on Earth has had, like, say, the impact of the Europeans on Aboriginal Australia, mm-hmm. there'd be many who'd say, we don't want that to happen to us.
That's a very good point. But, in fact, on the Earth, that type of contact was a physical contact. It was one advanced society coming in, technologically advanced society coming in, and dominating a less technologically advanced society.
Yes, and this will not be physical, it's just simply an electronic communication.
Absolutely. And in a sense, we would have that same type of difference in technology, because almost certainly the society, the civilization that we detect, would be more advanced technologically. They would probably be much older than we are. But because of the great distances in space, we're isolated. We can be assured that we'll never have physical contact. The contact that we have is through information, and we can slowly digest that information and evaluate it and incorporate it, if it's appropriate, into our society.
I notice you say we could never have physical contact. There's no chance of us ever going there or them coming to us.
Well, I shouldn't say never, but there's very little chance of ever doing that. When we look at the great distances between the stars, for example, the nearest star to our solar system is Alpha Centauri. It's a little over 4 light years away. If we were to develop a rocket that could perfectly convert matter into energy, this is the most efficient rocket we can think of, the amount of energy, and we could put this rocket together and perhaps send a few people to Alpha Centauri at a reasonably good fraction of the speed of light so that the travel time wouldn't be very long. In fact, in terms of the shipboard time, we could design it so that it would be just a matter of 4 or 5 years. And if we were to compute how much energy that takes, it's the equivalent of, 500,000 years of the United States energy usage. And you might say, well, that is, you know, that's rather not only anthropocentric, but it's too focused on the U.S. Well, that's a lot of energy when you add it up. It's 1% of the it's 1 second of the solar luminosity. It is 4 months of the total solar energy falling on the Earth, and that is a great deal of energy. When you start talking in terms of the output of a star, even a fraction of the output of a star, you're talking a great deal of energy. And that's just to send a few people to one star. And that seems like a great expense, no matter how advanced your civilization is.
So trekking around the universe a la Star Trek is just not on?
Not under our current understanding of the laws of physics. And so far, Einstein has proven right in every test.
So all we can do then is listen out, and hopefully one day we might pick up a signal.
I hope so, and perhaps in 1994 we'll do it from Parkes, Australia.
Well, if that happens, Peter, I'm sure the Space Show will be there to report it to the world.
I hope so.
Thank you for joining us tonight on the Space Show.
Thank you.